In the sitting room, Esme settled Caron in one of the wide low chairs, with the tray at his side, and herself chose a seat to his left, the heart side, to show her awareness of the family bond.
You have done us proud. And it's all over for you. The bad times, eh?
She had to expect other combat in the future. Surely Caron realized that. Perhaps he meant the recent trouble.
I certainly hope I never have to go through a court-martial again. Or the mutiny that led to it.
Oh, you did well. But that's not exactly what I meant. Though I'm sure it was unpleasant enough. But no more old nightmares.
How does he know about the nightmares? I'm doing all right.
Good. This is good. You know, even when I was still active, your father never stinted the good stuff when I came here. Of course, we both understood it was special, not something to be talked about.
What?
Your father, he didn't want me to talk about it, and I could see his point. You'd had that fever and nearly died. He wasn't sure what you remembered, and what was the fever dreams?
Esme fought her body to stillness. She wanted to shiver. She wanted to gag. She wanted to run away. She had done all those in past times without success.
It was the dreams. Just the fever. They said something I'd caught when I ran away. I can't even remember where I thought I was going, let alone where I got to.
She did remember a nightmare train ride, fragments of something else she tried not to think about. She did not know what tiny movement, a flicker of eyelid, a tension in the muscles along his jaw. But she knew at once that he knew something that she did not, which he longed to convey and felt he must conceal. Her scalp prickled.
Well, you want to find your father. That was simple. Your mother had died and you wanted him, and he was right there in the midst of a nasty little territorial dispute. That was when the Borlist branch of the Old Believers had decided to pull out of the regional planning web and take over the Upper Rift Valley.
Esme knew about that miscalled dispute. The Califer Uprising had been a civil war, small but intense.
No one realized you could read that well, let alone that you could read a map. You hopped on your pony with a week's food and set off.
On a pony?
Back then, you rode like a tick on a cow dog, and just as happy. You were hardly ever off your pony, until your mother died. And they were happy enough to see you back on it, until you disappeared.
She couldn't remember that. Couldn't remember a time when she would have chosen to spend all those hours on a horse. What she remembered was how much she hated it. The lessons and the sore muscles, and all the work of picking out hoofs and grooming and mucking out a stall.
I guess you'd planned pretty well, because they couldn't pick up your traces anywhere. No one thought of what you'd really done. They thought you'd gotten lost or gone up in the mountains and had an accident. And no one ever knew the whole story, because you didn't make a lot of sense when we found you.
The fever.
Esme was sweating now. She could feel it, like a sick slime all over.
Well, that's what your father said.
My father said?
You'd forgotten it all, with the fever. And all for the better, he said. Don't bring it up, he said. Well, I guess you know by now it wasn't all a dream. I suppose those fleet psych nannies dug it out and helped you deal with it, eh?
Esme was frozen. She was simmering in her own terror. Cold and hot at once, closer than she wanted to some terrible truth, and yet not able to move away. She could feel his gaze on her head, and knew if she looked up, she would not be able to hide her terror and confusion. Instead, she busied her hands among the little dishes of breads and condiments, pouring the tea, handing over a delicate cup and saucer. She could hardly believe her hands were so steady.
Not that I could have argued with your father, of course, under the circumstances. It was not only my duty to him as my commander, but he was your father. He knew best. Only I did wonder sometimes if you remembered something from before the fever. If perhaps that was what changed you.
Well, my mother had died, and I was sick so long.
If you had been my daughter, I think I would have told you. It helps the trainees to talk things through after a bad engagement.
My father thought differently.
Esme felt drought cracks opening in her mind, bottomless mouths to trap her.
Yes. Well, anyway, I'm glad you had the chance to deal with it in the end. But it must have been hard when you had the traitor captain to deal with, that second betrayal. Esmea, is something wrong? I'm sorry, I didn't mean...
It would be most helpful if you could simply tell me the story from your point of view. Remember, I had only my own somewhat fragmentary memories to go on, and the psych nannies found them somewhat inadequate.
The psych nannies would have found them inadequate if they'd found them at all, but they hadn't. They had assumed that anyone with her background would have had any such problems dealt with earlier. And she, convinced by her family's insistence that everything in the nightmares was just fever dreams, had been afraid to let them know she had problems. She'd been afraid of being labeled crazy or unstable, unfit for duty, rejected to come home a failure. Was this why her family had assumed she'd fail, even to the point of keeping her trail horse unassigned?
Perhaps you should ask your father.
I suspect he would be displeased at having his judgment questioned, even by the fleet's psychiatric specialists. It would be a help, if you wouldn't mind.
If you're sure, it's not a pleasant matter. But, of course, you knew that already.
Nausea bucked in her gut, sending sour signals to her mouth.
Not yet. Not until I know. I'm sure.
It had been a time of riot and civil disorder, when a single small child, if determined and sure of herself, could travel by pony and then by rail some 1,000 kilometers.
You'd always been good at explaining yourself. You could come up with a story the moment you were caught out. I suppose that's why no one really noticed you. You spun some yarn about being sent to an auntie or grandmother. And since you didn't act scared or confused and you had enough money, they let you on the trains.
All this was supposition. They had not been able to trace her path between the time she left the pony and the last part of her journey. The train she'd taken right into disaster.
The last dispatches home had given your father's station as Buhalo Barracks, and that's where the train would have gone. But in the meantime, the rebels had overrun the eastern end of the county, putting everything they had into an assault at the big arms depot at Butte Bagan. The force at Buhalo Barracks was too small to hold them. So your father had rolled aside to hook around and cut them off from the rear, while the 10th Cav moved up from Cavender to hit them in the flank.
I remember that.
Esme remembered it from the records, not from real memory. The rebels had counted on her father's reputation, which had never included leaving a plum like Buhalo unprotected. They had planned to immobilize his forces there with part of their army, while the rest went on to Butte Bagan and the supplies there. Later, his decision to abandon Buhalo and trap the rebel army would be taught as an example of tactical brilliance. He had done what he could for the town. The civilian population of Buhalo fled ahead of the rebels. They had been told which way to go. Most of them survived. But Esme, crammed in amongst refugees from earlier fighting, had ridden the train 2 stops too far. Both sides had mined the railroad, although the official reports said a rebel mine had blown the low bridge over the Sinets Canal just as the locomotive passed. Esme had never been sure. Would any government admit its own mines had blown up its own train? She did remember the enormous jolt that slammed the carriage crooked. They had been going slowly. She had been stuffed between a fat woman with a crying baby and a skinny older boy who kept poking her ribs. The jolt rocked the carriage, but didn't knock it over. Others weren't so lucky. Esme could just recall jumping down from the step, a big jump for her at that age, and following the woman and her baby for no reason than that the woman was a mother. The skinny boy had poked her once more, then turned away to follow someone else. Streams of frightened people scurried away from the train, away from the blowing smoke at the front end of the train. She had lost track of direction. She had forgotten, for the moment, which way she was supposed to go. She had followed the woman and baby, and they had been following others. And then her legs were too tired, and she stopped.
There was a little village the locals called Greer's Crossing. Not even one click from the train track where the shipping canal turned. You must have gone there with others from the train wreck.
And that's when the rebels came through.
That's when the war came through.
Esme glanced up to meet a gaze that no longer twinkled.
It wasn't just the rebels, as you know only too well.
I do.
It was right about there the rebels realized that they were being herded into a trap. Say what you like about Giovalantos. He had a tactical brain between his ears. And maybe he had good scouts, I don't know. Anyway, the rebels had been on the old road because they had some heavy vehicles, and so they had to go through the village to get across on the bridge. They were making a mess of the village because the people around there had never been supporters. I suppose they thought the people from the train had something to do with the loyalists.
The old memories forced themselves up, lumping under her calm surface. Esme could feel her face changing and struggled to keep the muscles still. Her legs had begun to hurt after the hours on the train, the crash, the fall. The woman, even with a baby, had longer legs and took longer steps. She had fallen behind, and by the time she got to the village, it was gone. Already, roofs had collapsed. What walls remained were broken and cantways. Smoke blew across streets littered with stones and trash and tree limbs and piles of old clothes. She could not classify the noises, except that they scared her. They tangled in her mind with her father's voice scolding her. She wasn't supposed to be so close to whatever made those noises. Blinded by stinging smoke, she had stumbled over one of the heaps of old clothes, and only then recognized it as a person. The child she had been had thought it a silly place for someone to go to sleep, a grown woman. And she had shaken the slack, heavy arm, trying to wake an adult to help her find her way. She had not seen death before, not human death. She had not been allowed to see her mother because of the fever. And it took her a long time to realize that the woman with no face would never pick her up and soothe her and promise that everything would be all right soon. She had looked around, blinking against the stinging in her eyes that was not all smoke, and saw the other piles of clothes, the other people, the dead, and the dying, whose cries she could now recognize. Even across the years, she remembered that the first thought she could recognize was an apology.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
That day, she had stumbled along the broken lane, falling again and again, crying without realizing it, until her legs gave out and she huddled into the corner of a wall where someone's garden had once held bright flowers. Shadowy figures moved through the smoke, some wearing one color and some another. Most, she knew later, must have been the terrified passengers on the train. Some were rebels. Later, they all wore the same uniform, the uniform she knew, the one her father and uncles wore. But Esme didn't remember. She couldn't remember, not all of it. She had remembered, and they'd said it was dreams.
It would have been better, I always thought, if they'd told you. At least when you got old enough. Being as the man was dead and couldn't hurt anyone again, least of all you. Bad enough for it to happen at all, no matter who did it. The rape of a child. Sickening. But to have it be one of ours.
Esme fixed on the one thing she could stand to know.
I didn't know he was dead.
Well, your father couldn't tell you that without bringing up the rest of it, could he? He hoped you'd forget the whole thing, or think it was just a fever dream.
He'd said it was a fever dream. He'd said it was over now, that she'd always be safe. He'd said he wasn't angry at her. Yet his anger had hovered around her, a vast cloud, dangerous, blinding her mind as the smoke had blinded her eyes.
You're sure?
That the bastard died? Oh, yes. I have no doubt at all.
You killed him?
It was that or your father's career. Officers can't just kill their men, even animals who rape children. But to wait, to charge him, that would have brought you into it. And none of us wanted that. Better for me to do it and take my lumps. Not that there was anything worse than a stiff chewing out at the end of it. Extenuating circumstances.
I'm glad to know that.
I always said you should have been told. Not that I talked about it, you understand. I said it to myself, I mean. It was no use arguing with your father. And after all, you were his daughter.
Don't worry about it.
Esme was finding it hard to pay attention. She felt the room drifting slowly away on a slow spiral to the left.
And you're sure you got it all sorted out? All but him being dead, I mean. They helped you in the RSS.
I'm fine. Don't worry about it.
No, I was surprised, you know, when you wanted to go off-planet and join them. Figured you'd had enough combat for any one life. But I guess it's your blood coming out, eh?
How do I get rid of him politely and discreetly?
Esme could hardly tell him to go away. She had a headache. Sweezas did not treat guests that way. But she needed, how she needed, some hours alone.
Esmea?
Esme looked up. Her half-brother Germond grinned shyly at her.
Father said, would you come to the conservatory, please? If you can excuse her, sir?
Of course. It's your family's turn now. Esmea, thank you for your time.
Coron bowed, very formal again at the end, and withdrew. Esme turned to Germond, now 15, all ears and nose and big feet.
What did Father want?
He's in the conservatory with Uncle Berto. He said you'd be getting tired of listening to old soldiers' tales, for one thing, and for another, he wanted to ask you more about Fleet.
Tell him Seb's gone, and I'll be out in a few minutes. I've gone upstairs to freshen up.
For once, the impenetrable assumptions of Altiplano society worked in her favor. No male would question her need to be alone for a few minutes with an array of plumbing fixtures, nor would they rush her. Esme went up the stairs by instinct. She was not seeing the brass rails holding the carpet snug to the risers, the scuffs on the steps themselves. Her body knew how to get up the stairs, around the corners, where to find the switches that gave her absolute privacy. She leaned against the wall, turned on the cold water tap, and put her hands into it. She wasn't sure why. She wasn't sure of anything, including the passage of time. The water cut off automatically, just as it would aboard ship, and she nudged the controls again. The curdled remains of lunch slopped into the clean swirl of water and disappeared down the drain with it. Esme cupped her hand under the faucet and drank a handful of the cold, sweet water. Her stomach lurched but steadied. She had never been prone to nausea. Not even then. Not even when the pain was so bad she'd been sure she was being torn apart. The real pain, not the imagined pain induced by fever dreams. In the mirror, she looked like a stranger, a gaunt old woman with flyaway dark hair, face streaked with tears and vomit. This would never do. Methodically, Esme took a towel from the rack, wet it, and cleaned her face and hands. She rubbed her face hard with the dry end of the towel until the blood returned and the greenish tinge of nausea disappeared under a healthy pink. She attacked her hair with damp hands, flattening the loose strands, then dried her hands. The water stopped again, and this time she didn't turn it back on. She folded the damp towel and hung it on the used rack. The woman in the mirror now looked more familiar. Esme forced a smile, and it looked more natural on that face than it felt on her own.
I should put on something.
She looked to see if she'd spotted her shirt. A few drops showed, dark against the pale fawn.
I'll change into someone else.
Her mind stumbled over something in the smoke that was all she could see. Still navigating by habit, she unlocked the door and returned to her own room. By the time she'd taken off the shirt, she knew she'd have to change from the skin out. She did that as quickly as she could, taking what lay on top in her drawers and glancing at herself only long enough to be sure the wide collar lay flat and untwisted around her neck. The pallor had gone. She looked like Esme Sweeza again. Esme fought her way through the choking dark clouds in her mind, trying to cling to what she remembered, what Seb Coron had told her. To any logic that could connect them, When the smoke cloud in her mind cleared, the first thing she recognized was smug relief. She had been right. She had known the truth. She had made no mistakes, except for the stupidity of leaving home in the first place, the idiocy of a child trying to travel cross-country in the midst of a civil war. She batted that critical voice down. She had been a child. Children were, by definition, ignorant of some things. In the essentials, in recognizing what she had seen, in telling the truth about what happened, she had been right. Rage followed that moment of delight. She had been right, and they had lied to her. They had told her she was mistaken, that she was confused by the fever.
Was there even a fever?
Esme started to call up the household medical records before her critical voice pointed out that of course the records would show such an illness, such a hospitalization. It could have been fabricated, all of it. How would she know? And to whom did she want to prove it? To everyone at that moment. She wanted to drag the truth before her father, her uncle, even Papa Stefan. She wanted to grab them by the neck, force them to see what she had seen, feel what she had felt, admit that she had in fact endured what she had endured. But they already knew. They knew, and yet they had lied to her. She could keep her own secret and let them think theirs safe, run away again as she had run before. They would be comfortable still, indulged by her complicity. Or she could confront them. She looked again in the mirror. That was the person she would become if she became an admiral like Harris Serrano's aunt. The diffidence, the uncertainty that had mocked her so often had burned away in the last hour. She did not yet feel what she saw in that face, but she trusted the eyes that blazed out at her.
Is he still in the conservatory? How long did this take?
The clock surprised her. She had been upstairs only half a local hour. She headed for the conservatory, this time with all senses fully awake. It might have been the first time she came down the stairs. She felt a slight give in the sixth from the bottom, noticed a loose tack on the railing side of the carpet, spotted a nick in the railing itself. Every sight, every smell, every sound. Her father and Bertol were stooped over a tray of bedding plants with one of the gardeners. Her new clarity of vision noticed every detail of the plants, the notched petals of fire orange and sun yellow, the lace-cut leaves. The gardener's dirt-blackened fingernails, where his hands were splayed out on the potting table. The red flush along the sides of her uncle's neck. White lines in the skin of her father's face, where he had squinted against the sun so long that the creases had not tanned. A loose thread on Bertol's sleeve button. Her foot scraped on the tile floor because she let it. Her father looked up.
Esmea, come see the new hybrids. I think they'll do very well in the front urns. I hope old Sebastian didn't wear you out.
He didn't. In fact, I found him quite interesting.
Is something wrong, Esme?
I need to talk to you, Father. Perhaps in your study?
Something serious?
Only if you consider a matter of family honor serious.
The gardener's hands jerked. The plants shivered. The gardener reached for the box of planters. Her father lifted his chin, and the man grabbed the box and scuttled away, out the back door of the conservatory.
Do you want me to leave?
Please.
Bertol flinched, his eyes shifting to her father, then back to her.
Esme, what?
You will know soon enough, but I would prefer to speak to Father alone just now.
Bertol flushed, but turned away.
Well, Esmea, there was no need to be rude.
The little muscles around his eyes and nose were tense. The contrast between his tanned skin and the untanned creases had almost disappeared. He should be able to put the sum together. She wondered if he would.
I talked to Seb Coron, or rather, he talked, and I found it most interesting.
Oh?
You lied to me. You said it was all a dream, that it didn't happen.
For a moment, Esme thought he would try to pretend he didn't understand. But then a quick wash of color rose to his cheeks and drained again.
We did it for you, Esmea.
No, not for me. For the family, maybe, but not for me.
For more than you, I admit. For the others, it was better that one child suffer that confusion.
Confusion? You call that confusion?
Esme's body ached with remembered pain, the specific pains that had specific causes. She had tried to scream. She had tried to fight him off. She had even tried to bite. The strong adult hands, hardened by war, had held her down easily, bruising her.
No, not the injuries. But not being sure what had happened. You couldn't tell us who, Esmea. You didn't really see him. And they said you would forget.
I saw him. I don't know his name, but I saw him.
You couldn't give us any details at the time. You were exhausted, terrified. You probably didn't even see his face. You've been in combat now as an adult. You know how confusing it is.
Show me the regimental roster. Show me, and I'll point him out.
You can't possibly, after all these years.
Sebastian says he killed him. That means you know who it is. If I can point him out, that should prove to you that I do remember.
You can't possibly.
But he led the way to his study without another word. He moved to the console and stabbed at the controls. Esme noticed that his fingers were shaking. She felt a calm satisfaction. Then he stepped back, and she came forward to look. The faces came up, six to a screen. She stared at them, one part of her mind sure that she would know, and another sure that she wouldn't. Had her father even called up the right year? He wanted her to fail, that was clear enough. He might have cheated, but she could not believe that of him, even now. Sweezes did not lie, and he was her father. He had lied before, because he was her father. She tore her mind away from that dilemma and stared at the screen. Esme did not recognize most of the faces at all. She had no reason to. She had not been to Boo Hollow Barracks after her father was posted there. She found a few faces, vaguely familiar, but unthreatening. They would have been men who had served with her father before, even among the household guard at the Estancia. Among them, a much younger Sebastian Coron, whom she recognized instantly. So her memory was clear in some details that far back. She did not look at her father as she scrolled through the list. It was hard enough to focus on the screen, to breathe through the tightness in her throat. Screen after screen. She heard her father shift in his chair, but he did not interrupt. Someone came to the door. She heard the rustle of clothing, but did not look up. Her father must have gestured, for without a word, she heard the rustle of clothing retreat. Through the entire enlisted ranks, and she had not found that face her mind refused to show her. Doubts chilled her. Surely Caron would have told her if it had been someone in another unit, or an officer.
Would he?
Esme made herself keep going, to the officer ranks. There at the head was her father, no gray in his hair, his mouth one long, firm line. Beneath, in descending order, the other officers. Esme's heart fluttered, then raced thunderously in her chest, spurred by the old fear. He stared out of the page, sleek and handsome, the honey-colored hair swept back. She remembered it darker, matted with sweat and dirt. But no doubt at all, not one. She knew his name. She knew his family. She had danced with his younger brothers at the Harvest Games, the year before she left Altiplano for the Stars. Her mouth was too dry to speak. She struggled to swallow, to clear her tongue. She had struggled then, too.
This.
She laid her finger on the image, surprised at the steadiness of her hand. Her finger didn't tremble at all. Her father got up. She could hear him coming up behind her and fought not to flinch away.
Oh, gods. You did. How did you...
I told you. I remember.
Esmea.
It was a plea, and his hand on her hair was another. She slid aside from it, pushing herself away from the console, scrambling out of the chair.
I didn't know his name. I was too young to have been introduced, even if he'd been at our house before. I couldn't tell you his name or give the kind of description that an adult might have been able to give, but I knew. You did not show me the roles then, did you?
Her father's face, when she looked, might have been carven in bleached wood. It looked dry and stiff, unnatural. Was that her vision or his reality? Her gaze wandered away around the room, just noticing the familiar things before moving on to something else.
Esmea, I'm sorry. Since you remember, you probably need therapy.
Therapy? Here? Here where the therapist told me it was all my imagination, all fever dreams?
I'm sorry.
She knew that tone. He could apologize, but that was supposed to be the end of it. She was supposed to accept the apology and let it go. Not this time. Not again.
We made a mistake, Esmea. We can't change that now. It's past. I can't possibly convince you how badly I feel about it. That it was a mistake. But there were reasons. I asked advice.
Don't make excuses. I'm not stupid. I can see what you would like to call the realities. He was an officer, the son of a friend. There was a civil war in progress. You could not risk a feud.
Memory reminded Esme that the young man's father had commanded a sizable force himself. Not merely a feud, but potentially a lost war. Her military training argued that a child's pain, even her pain, weighed less than an entire campaign. But the child she had been, the child whose pain still shaped her reactions, the child whose witness had been denied, refused that easy answer. She squeezed her eyes shut, trying to force back all the feelings that wanted to escape, shut them back into the darkness.
It did not take rejuvenation to make you prudent.
You need help, Esmea.
Probably I do. But not here. Not now.
You won't come back again, will you?
I don't know. Probably not. But you might as well know. I worked out a deal with Lucy for the herd.
Good. I shouldn't have done that, but I suppose I was still hoping you'd come home for good. Especially when they treated you like that.
And you treated me better.
I understand.
He didn't, but she wasn't going to argue, not now. Now she wanted to get away, far away, and have some time alone. She suspected she would have to spend some time with Fleet psych nannies in the end, but not now.
Please, Esmea, get help in your fleet if you won't accept it here.
I'm going to ride out to the valley. Just for a day. Tomorrow. I don't want company.
I understand.
No surveillance.
Esme met his gaze squarely. He blinked first.
No surveillance. But if you stay overnight, please let us know.
Of course.
Esme walked out into the afternoon, feeling nothing but a great light emptiness, as if she were a seed pod at summer's end, ready to blow away on the first autumn storm wind. Across the gravel drive, between the beds of flowers whose color hurt her eyes, across the sunlit fields beyond, where the shadows shifted and moved and called her name, but she did not answer. She came back when the sun fell behind the distant mountains, tired in ways that had nothing to do with walking however far she'd walked, and went into the dim entrance hall, where the smell of food and clatter of dishes stopped her short.
Dama?
Esme whirled, but it was one of the servants, offering a tray with a cup and a folded note. She shook her head to the cup of tea, took the note, and went upstairs. No one followed, no one intruded. The note, as she'd half expected, was from her great-grandmother.
Your father told me I am now free to talk to you. Come see me.
Esme put the note on the shelf above the clothes pole and thought about it. She had always assumed that her father obeyed his grandmother as she obeyed her grandfather. Though men and women had different roles, elders always ruled. She had thought so anyway, imagining the chain of authority coming down link by link from eldest to youngest through all the generations. Esme lay back on the bed, and as the hours passed, she could not find the strength to move, to get up and bathe or change her clothes or even turn away from the square of sky she could see darkening from blue to gray to the star-spangled midnight. It was all she could do to blink her eyes when they burned from staring at the window. It was all she could do to breathe.
Oh. Oh. Mm.
In the first light of dawn, she struggled up, stiff and miserable. How many mornings had she wakened stiff and miserable, hoping to see no one on the way to the baths, on the way out? And here she was again, supposedly a hero. She would have laughed at the thought if she could. Once more alone at the top of her father's house, once more awake and miserable after a sleepless night.
Get a grip.
A deep breath of the morning air, sweet-scented with the night-blooming flowers on the house wall. When she came down the stairs, she heard the familiar clatter in the kitchen, where the cooks were already at work. If she put her head in, hoping for a taste of the first baking, they'd want to talk to her. She went on, past the kitchen, to the storeroom. Inside, on the right, if the custom hadn't changed, was a stone jar of trail bread. Anyone could grab a handful, if headed out to do early chores. The stable, busy as always by daylight, with the grooms and their helpers scurrying from stall to stall. She went to the stable office, where she found her name at the top of the list of the day's riders. Her father had done that, probably the night before, and she felt no gratitude. In another hand, someone had written in a horse's name, Sam.
Dama?
Mm?
When you are ready, Dama.
I'm ready.
Esme realized she ought to have taken a water bottle, too, but she didn't want to go back for it. The groom went ahead of her, down the aisle of that barn and into another, and out again into the small training ring, where a bored brown horse leaned its chin on the rail where it was tied. A trail saddle, slicker, tied neatly behind the cantle, saddlebags, water bottle. Her father must have specified that, too. She hadn't needed to take the trail bread. A trail bridle, easy to unclip the bit so the horse could graze. A long lead line now clipped into the hitching rail's permanent loops. The groom offered his linked hands and she mounted. He unclipped the lead and handed her the end to tuck into the saddle ring.
He is good, but not too fast.
The groom opened the gate into the upper pastures. Esme turned the horse's head onto the trail that would, hours later, lead to her valley. Eventually, her stiff body relaxed into the rhythm of its walk, and she made herself look around. Morning light lit the recesses of the mountains on her right, and the vast, rolling pastures that spread from their foot as far east as she could see. She could remember riding out here from childhood. She had always taken a deep breath going out the gate, because it meant freedom. Thousands of hectares, dozens of trails, hidden wooded hollows, even in this open grazing land, and all the intricate topography of the mountains. No one could find her once she was out of sight of the house, or so she'd thought. Anger sat on one shoulder and grief on the other. The stink of old lies filled her nose, and she could not think of anything else. She had lived through the assault itself. She had, thanks to Seb Coron, outlived the assailant. But she had not outlived the effects. Worst of all effects, the lies. The horse ambled on, carrying her along as time did. Mere passage without change. Without the right change. Without healing. She could ride forever. The horse slowed, and she looked up to find they'd come to a fork in the trail. She legged it to the right, and it would not help. Nothing would help. Nothing could help.
Nothing on Altiplano, at least.
At the second fork, she turned right again. It was stupid going to the valley when she felt like this, and yet it had helped before. At other bad times in her life, she had gone there and found peace, at least for a while. She argued with herself, part of her defending her family even now. It wasn't true they had done nothing. The man was dead. But that was Seb Coron doing it for her father, not her father doing it for her. And what if Coron had lied about that? It wasn't true that her father hadn't cared. He'd done what he thought would help. But it hadn't helped, and he hadn't changed his mind. He, whose rule had been, if one thing doesn't work, try another. She rode beside the creek now, but its spring full rushing was too loud. In the shade of the trees, she felt cold. In the sun, she felt scorched. The horse sighed and pulled a little toward the water. She halted it, clambered off, feeling every stiff muscle, and led it down to drink. It laid its lips on the water and sucked. She could see the gulps rising up its gullet. She waited until it was finished, until it lifted its head and gave her a look, and then tried to stray off towards some buttonweed twigs. She didn't want to climb back on, but she had to. She walked instead, leading the horse until her legs felt better. By the sun, it was late morning. She didn't really want to go on to the valley, but where else could she go? Someone would ask, knowing where she always went. She pulled herself back into the saddle and rode on. The valley was smaller than she remembered, and she could feel nothing for it. The pines, the poplars, the creek, the meadow. She looked around it, trying to feel something. It was hers. It would always be hers. But all she felt was pain and emptiness. She slid off the horse and took the bit out of its mouth. She could walk around and let it graze for an hour before heading back. She remembered to loosen the girth, then took down a water bottle. Her body wanted food, but her mind did not. She made it halfway through the lunch the cooks had packed for her before her mind won the battle. She felt faint then and sat on the cold ground with her head down on her knees. The horse snatched at the grass nearby, the ripping and chewing of grass punctuating her thoughts.
What do I do?
Emptiness behind her, emptiness before her. In the middle of that emptiness, those few vivid moments when she had done something right and saved someone else. Harris Serrano. Vida Serrano.
What would they say now if they knew all this? Would it change anything?
She already had black marks against her. She had known from childhood that nothing in a military career is ever completely forgotten or forgiven. If she became not only the colorless, ordinary young officer from a backwoods planet who just happened to do the right thing once and save a Serrano neck, if she admitted that she was damaged, fractured, prone to nightmares, that had to put her in more jeopardy. That had to risk being thrown out, sent home. Except she had no home. Not this valley. Not anywhere. When her head cleared a little, she made herself drink again and eat the other half of lunch. This time it stayed down. It tasted like dust and wood, but it stayed down. She was home well before dark, handing over the dry, cool horse to the groom. Her stepmother hovered in the hall. Esme nodded politely.
I rode too far. I need a long bath and bed.
Could I send up a tray?
It was not her stepmother's fault. It had never been her stepmother's fault. She wasn't sure her stepmother even knew. If her father had kept it such a secret, perhaps she didn't know even now.
Thank you. Soup and bread would be fine. I'm just too tired.
Esme was able to get herself in and out of the bath, and she ate the food on the tray when it came. She put the tray back out in the hall and lay on the bed. She could just see the corner of her great-grandmother's note on its shelf. She didn't want to see it. She didn't want to see anything. The next morning was marginally better. Lucy, who clearly knew nothing, wanted her to come watch a schooling session with the brown mare. Esme could think of no polite way out of it, and partway through the session came out of herself far enough to notice that the problem with the canter depart was Lucy's failure to keep her outside hip in place. Lucy accepted this with good grace and offered a tube of liniment for Esme's obvious stiffness. They went in to lunch together. In the afternoon, her conscience would not let her avoid her great-grandmother any longer.
You are very angry with me.
Her great-grandmother did not look up from her embroidery. She had to use a thick lens and a special light, but she worked on it every day, Lucy had said.
I am angry. Mostly with him, I think.
I am still angry with him. But I am too old to put much energy into the anger. It's very tiring anger, so I ration it. A sharp word a day, perhaps.
Esme suspected humor at her expense, but the old woman's face had a soft vulnerability that she'd never noticed before.
I will say I was wrong, Esmea. It was how I was brought up, but it was still wrong of me. Wrong not to tell you, and wrong to leave you as I did.
I forgive you.
Don't do that. Don't lie to me, of all people. Lies added to lies never make truth. You don't forgive me. You can't forgive me that fast.
I don't hate you.
Don't hate your father either. Be angry with him, yes. He has hurt you and lied to you, and anger is appropriate. You need not forgive him too soon, any more than you forgive me. But don't hate, because it is not natural to you, and it will destroy you.
I'm going away as soon as I can, and I'm not coming back.
I know. Lucy told me about the herd. You are right. And I will argue for Lucy when the time comes.
Thank you.
It was all Esme could say. She kissed the old woman and went away. The days crept by, then the weeks. She counted them off. She would not cause a scandal by moving to the city for the rest of her leave, but she could not help watching the calendar. Her resolve had hardened. She would go and never return. She would find someone, not Lucy, who had no feel for it, but someone else, to become the Valley's guardian. Nothing here meant anything to her now but pain and sorrow. The very food tasted bad in her mouth. She and her father had spoken each day of other things. She had been amazed at both of them, the way they could evade any mention of or reference to that disastrous afternoon. Her stepmother took her shopping in the city. She allowed herself to be draped in suitable clothes. She packed them into her duffel to take along. Then it was the last week, the last 5 days, the last four. She woke one morning, stabbed by the sorrow that she had been in her valley, but she had not seen it. She had to go one more time. She had to try to salvage something, some real memory that was also a good memory from her childhood. She had been riding almost every day, just to keep Lucy company. So if there was a horse free, she could go now, today. For the Dama, there was always a horse free. She felt, if not happy, at least positive, the pull of fleet, probably, the knowledge that in just a few days she would be back in her new home, forever. The valley opened before her, magical again, as it had been in her childhood, as she would remember it in the moment of her death. It hardly deserved the name of valley, although when Esme had first seen it, she'd been so young it seemed large. Now she could see that what she remembered was merely a saucer in the side of the mountain, a grassy glade in which a small pool trickled away in a murmuring stream that would become a rushing, noisy stream only further down. On one side were the dark pines, secretive, rising from rocky ledges, and facing them were the white-boled poplars with their dancing leaves. In this brief mountain spring, the new grass was spangled with pink and yellow and white, the windflowers and snowflowers. A few weeks later, the tall scarlet and blue lupins would bloom, but now all the flowers lay close to the ground. Esme leaned back in the saddle. She wanted to breathe in and in, filling herself with the resinous scent of pine, the crisp scent of mint and grass, the sweetness of the flowers, the tang of poplar, and even the sour, rank smell of the lush weeds near the water. She could feel tears rising, and she clamped down on her emotions. Instead of crying, she dismounted and led her horse forward to drink from the pool. Then she removed the saddlebags and slung them over her shoulder. She led the horse to the fallen pine, still there after all these years, and unsaddled it. She put the saddle over the leaning trunk, then hobbled the horse before removing the bridle. The horse worked its way back out into the sunshine in the meadow grass, where it set to grazing. Esme settled herself on the convenient rock she had placed years before and leaned back against the saddle. She unbuckled the left saddlebag and took out the meat-filled pastries Veronica had packed. She would have 5 hours of peace here before she had to start back. She could hardly believe it was hers now. She belonged to it, to this chill rock with its multicolored lichens, to the trees and the grass, to the mountain itself. But by law and custom, as their saying went, it was now hers. By custom and law, she could bar anyone from trespassing here. She could fence it, shield it, build a house here that no one ever entered but herself. It had been her dearest dream once. A little cabin, one or two rooms, all to herself, with no memories in it, here in this golden place. She had been a child then. In her daydream, food had appeared on the table without any effort of hers. Breakfast had been cereal with cream and honey. Someone else, some invisible magical person, had washed the sticky bowl. She had always been out for lunch, usually perched on a rock high above, watching the sky. Dinner in those dreams had been fish from the stream, sweet-fleshed mountain trout, lightly fried. Not this stream, it was too small, but downstream a few kilometers. She had fished there, the time she camped here for a week. Reality, not dreams, by then, the summer she was 11. The fish were as tasty as she'd imagined, but the hike back and forth had convinced her that she would have to find another food source. Papa Stefan had been furious. So had her father when he came back from the situation in Carfra. There was always a situation in Carfra. Her stepmother had panicked, convinced that Esme had killed herself. Remembering that unsavory row, Esme felt herself knotting up, the cold of the stone striking deep. She pushed herself off the rock and walked out into the sun, stretching out her arms to it. Even at 11, she had known she would never kill herself, no matter what. Had Aris ever told her father? Probably not. She would have been afraid to introduce any more tension, any more difficulty between father and daughter.
Poor Aris.
Esme closed her eyes against the sun as she lifted her face to it. She had been 6 years too late with her sympathy, 6 years too late with her shock and horror. Now she could understand how futile Aris must have felt with a stepdaughter so awkward, so independent. Esme walked down the slope to the open grass. She crouched, putting a hand to the ground. It was cool. Only on the hottest midsummer day would the ground feel warm up here, but not as cold as the rock. She let herself down onto the grass and leaned back with her hands clasped behind her head. Above, the morning sky burned blue, the exact blue that felt right, that made her happiest. She had never found that blue on another planet. Under her shoulders and back, the land upheld her with just enough pressure.
You're not making it easy!
Here and now, she could not imagine leaving Altiplano forever, giving this up forever. The horse, a few rods away, waggled an ear at her, but went on munching. She stretched out on her side and looked at the flowers, reminding herself of their names. Some were original terraforming rootstock, and others had been developed here for this particular world from Terran gene lines. Pink, yellow, white, a few of the tiny blue-violet starry ones she had privately named wish stars. She had had private names for all of them, really, taken from the plant names in the old stories, whether or not they were really related. She touched them now with a fingertip, renaming them. Pink rosemary, yellow campion, crisp white primroses. It was her valley. These were her flowers, and she could give them her names. Forever. She looked over at the horse. It was grazing steadily, not so much as an ear flick to indicate any danger. She leaned her head back on her arm again. She could feel the warmth of the sun where it touched her, and the coolness of the shadows. She felt herself relaxing, as she had not relaxed since she arrived, or for how long before, and let her eyelids sag shut. She rolled her face into the fragrant grass to get the annoying sun off her eyelids. Esme woke with a jerk as a shadow stooped over her. Even as she lunged up, she recognized the horse. It plunged away, fighting the hobbles, frightened because she was.
You scared me!
Yes, I scared you too. Sorry.
Esme looked around. She had slept at least an hour, more likely two, and she could feel the heat of sunburn on her ear. She had worn a hat, but not when she lay down.
Idiot.
When her heart slowed, she felt better, rested. Lunch, her stomach reminded her. She walked back to the rock, shaking the kinks out of legs and arms, and then took her hat and the lunch sack back into the sun. Now she was ready for that meat pasty, and the horse would enjoy the apple. After lunch, she walked down by the stream and let her mind loose again. She had come home and found the truth, and it had not killed her. She didn't like it. It hurt, and she knew it would continue to hurt. But she had survived the first terrifying hours as she had survived the initial assault in childhood. She felt shaky, but not in danger of dissolution. Was she ready to give this up, this lovely valley that had helped her cling to sanity so often? She knelt and put her hand into the stream's icy flow. She loved this sound, the smell of the pungent herbs on its bank, the feel of icy water on her hands and face when she knelt to drink. She did not have to decide now. She had years. If she stayed in Fleet, if she qualified for rejuvenation, she had many, many years. Long after her father died, long after everyone who had betrayed her died, she could come home to this valley, still young enough to enjoy it. She could build her cabin and live here in peace. It would not have to hurt to return. She could avoid that pain just by persisting. Against this vision rose the vivid, eager face of her cousin Lucy. If she gained her peaceful valley at the end by simply outlasting those who had betrayed her, Lucy would be old, perhaps dead.
How many normal lifetimes will I live before I've earned retirement and the peace of my valley?
Esme would like to have Lucy for a friend as well as a business partner. Lucy, who now looked up to her, as she could not recall anyone in the family looking up to her before.
It's not fair.
An icy breeze slid down the creek bed and chilled her. Stupid complaint. Life was not about fairness.
He lied to me!
The horse threw up its head, ears pointed at her. He watched her with the suspicion of the edible for the eater. Esme felt her rage draining away. Not really gone, but its immediate pressure eased. She spent another hour wandering around the glade, drifting in and out of moods like the clouds drifting in and out of sight above the slopes. Finally, as the afternoon shadows began to climb the boulders, she caught and saddled the horse again. As she unlooped the hobbles and prepared to mount, the horse eyed her and flicked an ear.
Yes, and I scared you out of your wits, didn't I? You're not used to that kind of behavior from Sweezes.
The upper pastures, when she came to them, were still in sunlight, out of the shadow of the mountains. Far away to the south, she saw a drift of cattle moving slowly. In the distance, the buildings of the estancia were nestled in green trees like little toys, bright painted. For some reason, she felt a rush of joy. It passed through her to the horse, which broke into a trot. She didn't feel her stiffness. Without realizing she was going to, she legged the horse into a canter and then let it extend into a gallop. Wind burned her face. Her hair streamed back. She could feel each separate tug on her scalp, and the power of the galloping animal beneath her lifted her beyond fear or anger. The team from Special Materials Analysis came off the commercial line at Comus along with all the other passengers, some 130. Here, in the interior of the Familius, the customs checks were perfunctory. A glance at the ID, a glance at the luggage, their matching briefcases, matching duffels, all with the company logo.
Consultants, eh?
That's right.
Gory smiled at the man, that friendly open smile which was just a bit too memorable sometimes. Arhas wondered if he should have let Gory come, but Gory was the best with such devices, faster by 30 seconds than anyone else. He would edge their profit up on the Fleet contract, too. 30 seconds 100 times a day was 50 minutes off the top.
What a life. Wish I could be a consultant.
The customs man waved them through.
They always think it's glamorous. If they had to be on the road all the time, hear the complaints at home.
You didn't have to marry that loser.
This was an old script. One Losa and Pratt could improvise around for an hour.
He's not a loser. He's just sensitive.
Artists. I don't know why intelligent women always fall for losers who claim they're creative.
He is not a loser. He's sold 3 works.
In how long?
Stop it. It's not important. Gori, let her alone. She's right. People think our job is glamorous, and if they knew what it's really like on the road all the time, working long hours for people who are already angry that they had to hire us, they'd know better. But no more personal problems on this trip, all right? We're going to be stuck out here long enough without making it seem longer.
Gori cast a sidelong look at Losa.
All right.
I need to stop in here.
Losa ducked into a lady's without looking at Gori at all. Arhas glanced at Gori, who shrugged. Pratt shook his head. The 2 junior women, technicians newly hired from a large firm which hadn't offered them enough challenge, glanced at each other and made a tentative move toward the ladies.
Go on. We've got enough time.
She's the sensitive one.
Stop it. It doesn't help, and we can't run her life.
The rest of the team caught up with them and formed a clot in the passage until Losa and the other women reappeared. Then, not speaking, they moved on to the gate that divided fleet space from civilian space. Here, instead of a bored civilian customs inspector, they faced a cluster of alert, edgy military guards. Arhas handed over his ID case.
Arhas Asperson, Special Materials Analysis Consulting. And this is the contract.
A data cube, embossed with Fleet's own insignia on one side, and an elaborate marbled etching on the others. It had taken them 2 years to develop a duplicate of Fleet's equipment, so that they could fabricate their own cubes rather than having to steal and reprogram them. Then they'd gotten this perfectly legitimate contract and hadn't needed to use their fake.
Yes, sir. And how many in your group?
7.
Arhas stood aside, while the second guard collected everyone's ID cases. He would have worried, on Sierra Station, even with a real fleet cube. Though they had used the faked fleet cubes before, and faked ID before, fleet was unusually alert, thanks to the repercussions from Xavier. Here, he expected no trouble. And in fact, the cube reader had already accepted, then spat out, the fake cube.
All clear, sir. We have to check all the luggage, of course.
Of course.
Asperson handed over his own duffel and briefcase. Standard civilian electronics, data pads, cube reader, cubes, portable computers in all sizes from pocket to briefing, communications access sets, data probe wands. The guard held up the comm access set and the data wand.
You can't use this shipboard, sir.
No, I understand. Last time out, your people provided a shielded locker.
We can do that, sir.
Inexperienced consultants sometimes insisted that they would not give up any of their equipment. They got no more contracts. The other guard, Arhas noticed, was calling someone in fleet territory, and soon a lowly pivot appeared with a luggage truck and a lockable container for the restricted electronics.
You don't have to lock it up now. If you want to place calls from the fleet areas, that's permissible from any blue-coated booth. But before boarding...
We understand.
Arhas knew there would be another search before they boarded. The fleet area of Coma Station had its own eating places, its own bars, its own entertainment and shopping outlets, and even public rental sleeping. They had plenty of time before their ship left. On the fleet shuttle to Sierra Station, they took meals with the officers in the small wardroom.
What exactly is your area of expertise, Dr. Asperson?
Arhas allowed his mouth to quirk up at one corner, restrained amusement at the naivete of the young officer's question.
My degrees are in logical systems and substrate analysis.
Substrate?
Classified, I'm afraid.
Lieutenant, I believe you have duties forward.
The young officer looked to the lieutenant commander at the head of the table.
Oh, of course, sir.
He scurried out. The lieutenant commander wore no name tag. None of the officers aboard such a small ship wore them.
Sorry about that. We're not usually carrying civilians.
Of course. But you understand our situation.
Certainly. Only, I didn't recognize your firm's name.
Subcontractors, you know how it is. We used to work for the big firms, one and another of us, and then we struck out on our own. Got our first jobs as sub-subs, and now we're all the way up to subcontractors.
Must be hard, going out on your own after working for a big company.
It has been. But we're past wondering how we're going to pay the rent.
The officer smiled knowingly at the quality of the clothes they wore, the expensive cases they carried.
Imagine you are.
Not that it's easy profit. We're working harder than we used to, but it's for ourselves. And you, of course.
Of course.
At Sierra Station, they had no customs to pass, nothing but a long walk down one arm of the station and out another. They did have an escort, ostensibly to ensure that they didn't get lost. Civilians did not wander the fleet sections of stations, especially stations this near the border, without an escort. With the comfortable ease of someone who had not intended mischief anyway, the team ambled along. Kosciusko's docking bay was actually a shuttle bay. Here, Arhas handed the contract cube to the ranking guard, who fed it into a cube reader.
I'll call over, sir, but it'll be at least 2 hours before a shuttle comes in. The pod's halfway over with an arriving officer, and the shuttle's already loaded with cargo. No room for you. And it's down at Orange 17 anyway.
No problem. Is there someplace to get a drink, meanwhile?
Not really. There's a food machine just down the corridor there between the toilets, but nothing really good.
He means nothing really edible. Station food service is supposed to replace those snacks before they turn green, but...
Well, we can call in for something. They deliver from Civ's side, but there's a fee.
That would be great. The ship we came in on was skewed 5 hours off station time by the last jump. And I, for one, would enjoy something. And if it's near a break for you...
No, thank you, sir. Yeah, here's the order list.
A bright-eyed young man escorted them from the docking bay.
Ever been aboard a DSR before?
No. Main station yards, a couple of cruisers, but no DSR.
Well, let me get you a ship chip.
The youngster touched a control panel, entering a sequence so fast that Arhas couldn't figure out the placement of sensors on the unmarked surface. Tiny disks rattled into a bin below the panel. Arhas looked at his, wondering how to activate it.
Voice activated. It'll project a route from your position to the location you name, for the low security areas, that is. If you need access to the high security areas, you'll have to get it reset. That'll be in ship admin, which it'll guide you to. I will. That's where you're going first. But any other time...
Thank you.
They spent the first several days looking over the inventory and discussing their plan with the senior technician, a balding master chief named Furlough.
I think headquarters has its head up its ass again. Rekeying all the weapons guidance codes? That assumes the people doing the job are competent and loyal. Not that I'm saying you aren't. But it's too big a job to go without hitches.
You're probably right, but I'm not going to pass up a contract. It's how we make a living.
Yes, well... I know you've got clearances from transcendent deities or something, but on my watch, these weapons are my responsibility, and I'll have one of my people with you.
Of course. We don't want any misunderstandings either. This is the protocol we were sent. I'm assuming you have the other part.
Yes, sir, I do.
The chief took Arhas's version and peered at it.
Discussing a waste of time, but it'll work. How long did you tell him it would take?
5 minutes per weapon, an hour to retool between types. That's what it took on the racks they mocked up for us to bid on. We were 1 minute faster than the next fastest on each, and a solid 10 minutes faster in retooling. Then, when they had us work on a patrol craft, we were able to work that fast even in tight situations. We weren't told what your inventory was, of course. We're just supposed to do it until it's done. Then when the other ships return from deployment, we'll do theirs as well.
I imagine that there weren't many people that wanted to spend a standard year or more out here in Sector 14.
Not that many. Fleet had a lot of contracts to hand out for this work, and most of them were either bigger, smaller, or in more popular places. We happened to fit the profile for this one, and we performed well in the test series.
Huh. Well, you've got your work cut out. We store the weaponry for all of Sector 14. There's no rear supply depot out here because of security concerns. Sierra Station gets a fair bit of civilian traffic, and we know some of its Bloodhorde agents.
We'd better get started then, hadn't we?
The chief still didn't move.
Not gonna be that easy. This thing is big, but it's not big enough to hold inventory like that in convenient arrays. Weapons and guidance systems are stored separately. And since the guidance systems are compact, we've squirreled them away wherever they'd fit. It's not anything like the way you've worked on that patrol ship. At least we have an automated system. Let me show you some video.
He ran his hand over the control panel on his desk, and a display came up on the wall. Racks rose from the deck to the overhead, the familiar pattern of automated inventory systems controls along the vertical rails.
That's one of the inventory bays in which guidance systems are stored. Because the guidance systems are small, and most of the time we're not restocking the warships, we fit them in by size, not by type.
So we're going to have to go through there and pull them out one at a time?
Not quite that bad. One rack at a time, though. Now, this bay right now has...
The chief flicked another control that brought up a display on his desk.
8,264 ASAC 32 modules. But they're on at least 8 different stacks, and I bet that someone has moved at least a few of them when restocking other goods and hasn't bothered to update the file.
Won't your automated system do that?
The chief wobbled his hand in the age-old gesture.
So-so. High-security items have a tracer that sounds off if they're removed from that hole, but not if they're moved a few meters. We just spend all our time rekeying the tracers. We're always having to move things in and out.
So you know they're in there, and you probably know where most of them are, but...
But not all. Which is why it's a stupid idea, thought up by someone who's never seen a big repair inventory. I hope they're paying you a daily allowance and not by piece, or you're going to be here forever and earn nothing.
Arhas wasn't sure that prospect would bother the chief, but it certainly bothered him. He had worried that the job wouldn't take long enough, that he'd have to stretch it out, that they wouldn't need to wander over enough of the ship to find the self-destruct. Instead, they would be here far too long, and although they'd have wide access, they might be too busy to use it.
I wonder if someone leaked this problem to Baran Hing and Company, and that's why they didn't bid on this job.
He watched the chief's face. No flicker, but... someone had to have leaked it.
At least we're getting a per diem. But it's gonna be a bitch.
Arhas eyed his partners and gave a meaningful glance at the gray cylinder on the table between them. Fleet would expect them to disable the simpler scans of their compartment. Arhas had not concealed the device. Now he turned it on. Telltales blinked hotly. It had detected signals it could not fog. He'd expected that. Right now, it was important for Fleet to think its more delicate scans worked here. What lay concealed within the familiar cylinder, under the Morin Company seal, was for later use and more private conversations. His partners would know that and would interpret what he said in the light of the caution now necessary.
We have a problem.
Arhas quickly repeated the chief's explanation of the way weapons guidance systems were stored on Kosciusko.
It's going to take a lot longer than we thought. It might be better to start with the weapons on the warships, since they're in the arrays we know.
But our contract states that we should begin with the DSR.
Yes, but they didn't tell us the whole story. With this arrangement, there'll be a lot of dead time. We'll be waiting around while they figure out where some of the weapons are. I'm considering whether to discuss a restructuring of the whole job.
It would be difficult with a signed contract. He would have to prove that Fleet had not provided necessary information. He wasn't sure he could trust that Chief Furlow to give evidence if it came to that.
Suggestion?
Go ahead.
Why not split the team and send some of them over to the larger warships? That way, the man hours lost in dead time won't be as great.
Possibly. In fact, that's a good idea. We won't have to worry about them.
Noticing anything he didn't say, but Gori's upward twitch of eyebrow meant he'd understood exactly what Arhas didn't say.
We don't look like whiners, we get the job done faster, and we're here to show that our top people cope with the unexpected.
Arhas thought it over, liking the idea better every moment. The one thing they'd worried about was having one of their own people notice something. Yet the fleet contract had required a larger team. This way, he got rid of those bright, inquisitive minds in a way that could cast no suspicion on the partners.
Good, then. I'll speak to the Admiral's office. If we're sending people off, we need to do that before we leave Sierra.